All right. The people that I'd like to speak about this morning, we spoke about Moshe Rabbeinu, and I want to talk about Yoshua and Devorah. Okay, we're moving in chronological order. Okay, Yoshua. First of all, Yoshua has the daunting job of taking over for the greatest Jew who ever lived. This is a pretty difficult job, pretty enormous shoes to fill. Here it is. Moshe Rabbeinu took the Jews out of Mitzrayim. He led them through the Yamsuf, brought down the Luchot, provided man in the desert, 40 years in the Midbar, spoke with HaKadosh Baruch Hu face to face like no other human being ever did or ever will do. And now Yoshua is told, all right, you take over for that guy. All right, is it any wonder that four times in the first parak they have to keep saying to him, Chazak v'yamatz, Chazak v'yamatz? So I'm pretty sure it's like not the type of thing, oh yeah, I got this. Okay, just nothing, right? So Yoshua now has to take over, and you can see the generation gap, again, right in the first parak. Moshe Rabbeinu is described as Moshe Avdi, right? Eved Hashem, and Yeshua is just Misharet Moshe. All right, so Moshe is Eved Hashem, and Yeshua is the Misharet of Moshe Rabbeinu. Okay, again, Yeshua is now taking over. Now, it doesn't mean Yeshua wasn't qualified. In fact, we have only good things to say about Yeshua. It's pretty amazing. All the people in Tanakh that have, you know, a decent amount written about them, very few do not have negative things written about him. Yeshua is like one of these very few. What do we know about Yeshua? Yeshua is a Talmud Chacham, right? He's a Talmud Mufaka Moshe Rabbeinu, right? It says about him, Malay Ruach Chachma. He's filled with Ruach Chachma. He is a Navi. Ish Asher Ruach Bo. Hashem speaks to him 14 times in Sefer Yeshua. And according to Chazal, he writes the last 8 psukim of the Torah. He is a shofet in regard to Achan, judging Achan, but also in regard to the Gemara and Baba Kama tells us when they came in, he made 10 takanot about upon entering Eretz Yisrael. He is a military general, right? Beginning with Amalek and ending with 31 kings in Eretz Yisrael. And he even has a din of a melech, because at the end of the first parak, they say, anyone who rebels against you will kill him. So this is, you know, this pretty amazing thing. There are 4 main events, I think, or experiences that Yeshua has in his life that sets him apart from others, that makes him eminently qualified to become the subsequent leader to Moshe Rabbeinu. First of all, he was absolutely subservient to Moshe Rabbeinu. He's loyal. There are only 2 human beings that saw the first Luchot, Moshe and Yeshua, before Moshe broke it. How does Yeshua see it? Yeshua is standing there at the foot of the mountain waiting for his Rebbe to come back. Moshe Rabbeinu went up, and Yeshua just waits. And he waits. And he waits some more, and he waits 40 days. When Moshe comes down, he hears the sounds of the eagle, and he says, Yeshua, what's going on? He goes, no idea. Because he's not there. Because Yeshua is waiting for his Rebbe. It's like, you know, when you come out of the airport, and you want somebody to greet you, you know, go through, and there's no one there. It's like, so Yeshua, I don't want Moshe to feel that way. Come down, there's no one there. Who knows when he's coming back? Maybe get out early. You know, Yeshua is waiting there for his Rebbe. When Moshe sets up his tent outside of the Machaneh, Yeshua goes with him. Yeshua, lo yemush mitoch ha'oel. He cared for covet of his Rebbe so much, according to Chazal, when Eldad and Medad started running through the Machaneh, saying Nevuah. What was the Nevuah? What was the Nevuah? Moshe's going to die. Yeshua's going to take over. Yeshua gets offended for his Rebbe. Adoni Moshe, he says. Adoni Moshe, kilaim. He knew his Rebbe inside out. And that's why he is referred to not just as the Talmud. Talmud is somebody who, you know, he was in Shir. He was with the Rebbe for an hour. He was Misharet. He was with his Rebbe all the time. Right? I was Zocha to be in the Rav Shir for a year. Okay, my friend was Zocha to be his Misharet. He was in the apartment. He was with him all the time. His relationship with Rav Soloveitchik was so different than my relationship. Yeshua was the Misharet of Moshe Rabbeinu, not just the Talmud. He knew his Rebbe inside out. Because of this, he becomes the next link in the chain. He's chosen by God, not Moshe, chosen by God. I want him to take over. Moshe kibel tzara misinai, u'masra liYoshua. Yeshua continues. Now, when he takes over as the leader, he is told, in order to be a Jewish leader, you have to make sure that you're always learning. V'gisavo yomam v'layla. This phrase we say all the time. It's not a pasuk in Chumash. It's a pasuk here in Yeshua. V'gisavo yomam v'layla. Yeshua has to make sure that no matter what, he has to set aside time for learning. That's part of Jewish leadership. Yoshua does for the second generation like events that they missed out from the first generation. There's sort of like a do-over of Kriyas Yamsuf when they go through the Yarden. There's like a do-over sort of Maimar Har Sinai with Har Eval and the Brachot and the Klalot. And even in the first parak, he gets Bnei Yisrael to say Na'aseh Nishma. And even though he begins as the Misharet of Moshe, by the time he dies, at the end of the Sefer, he too is called Eved Hashem. Now, like Moshe Rabbeinu, who, when they were fighting Amalek, had his hands raised, Yoshua has a battle, and he also has his hands raised in the battle against Ai. The second battle of Ai was a tikkun for the taking of the spoils of war of the Shlal. Achan took the spoils of war. Why? Because he said, Magiali. I fought. Spoils in war, this was mutter. It's mutter in the Torah. Okay? Soldiers didn't get paid that much. The payoff was, you get to take the spoils from war. Achan felt, we fought. Yes, HaKadosh Baruch Hu brought down the walls, but afterwards it was a battle. We fought. It would be like in Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau's autobiography. It's a fantastic sefer. You should read it. He talks about speaking about the miracles of the Six-Day War. In the miracles of the Six-Day War, one person got offended. He said, I fought in that. You want to tell me that all the, you know, loss of life, friends of mine who died in battle, people who were permanently wounded, all of that was nothing, it was just a miracle, we didn't do anything? So it was very difficult. Achan probably felt the same way. We fought Magiali. And trying to show that Kadosh Baruch Hu was the reason behind it. Okay, Moshe Rabbeinu recognizes the strength comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If you recognize the strength comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then maybe afterwards you could take the Shlal. There's a very famous pasuk that is often quoted, and no one quotes the second pasuk. There's a pasuk that says, "V'amarta kochi v'otzim yadi asel et ha'chayel hazeh." Right? People often say you shouldn't feel that I did everything, and people might come and say, "Look, you know, I did it." And that's wrong. Don't say that. And that's usually where people stop. And therefore they think that, what's the pasuk teaching me? I don't have to do anything. Kadosh Baruch Hu will do it all for me. Right? I don't need to fight. I don't need to do anything. I'd say Tehillim and learn and everything's good. But that's not true. The next pasuk says, rather, v'zecharta et Hashem lokecha ki hu hanotein lecha koach lasot kayam. You have to recognize Kadosh Baruch Hu is the one who gave you the strength to be such a good soldier, to give you the strength to go and do this. That's the message. Not that we don't do. Of course we do. It's absolute hishtadlus. But we have to recognize that it all comes from a Kadosh Baruch Hu. Right? Recognize that it comes from a Kadosh Baruch Hu. The intelligence that I have, the ability that I have, the strength that I have, all of that comes from a Kadosh Baruch Hu. Of course we fight. But we have to recognize that it all comes from a Kadosh Baruch Hu. At the end of Yeshua's life, he gives an impassioned speech about Chasdei Hashem, recognizing his role as just a link in the chain. He reviews all of Jewish history and recognizing that we're just a part of a greater scheme. And like David HaMelech, we know in Ashrei, which letter is missing in Ashrei? Nun. Why is Nun missing? Why is Nun missing? What? We don't want to say Nofel. Which is very funny because, what, there's no psukim that begin with a Nun that are positive? And there's no bad psukim that begin with Aleph, you know, through Taf. We go through Eich, it's an alphabetical order. You know, all the time. We have psukim, we can find a pasuk that's negative. So what's the idea that there is no nun? So why do we say nofel? Because the next pasuk is Sofmech Lechol Anoflim. I think that's what the idea, that David HaMelech is trying to tell us, that when there are nefilot, it's not Hashem's fault. When there are nefilot, that's on us. And the Kodesh Baruch Hu is there to be Somech Kol Anoflim. He's there to help us even when we fall. He doesn't have to, because we brought this upon ourselves, but he's still there. That's what David HaMelech is teaching, and that's what Yeshua says at the end of his speech. He says that Kodesh Baruch Hu did everything he was supposed to do. Now there's also the pockets of land that we didn't yet conquer. So Yeshua is trying to say, God did his part. Now it's upon us to finish the job. But that's the attitude that we have to have. If things don't go well, that's on us. We have to realize that Kadosh Baruch Hu gave us all the possibility for success. Okay, the next event would be Yoshua as one of the two famous spies who bring back the good report. Okay? Okay? In fact, based on this, Yeshua is the only person not involved in both major sins. He's not there even in the camp for Egel Azav. We said he's waiting for Moshe Rabbeinu. And he, with Kalev, come back, and they give the great report that we can do it. Kalev gives this spontaneous outburst, and Yeshua waits. I think it's more balanced approach, but saying the same, that we can do it, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is with us. Now, why doesn't Yeshua speak right away? So, one of two ideas, I think. It's probably more. Either one, of course, if he speaks, he's not going to speak up right away. He's a company man. He's Moshe's right up. What do you expect Yeshua to say? Once Kalev spoke up, he can chime in. Or, based on what we said before, Eldad and Medad, it looks a little self-serving to say, let's go in. Because based on the Nevuah, Moshe's going to die and I'm going to be the leader. So of course you want to go in. Maybe the people didn't want to go in. They were happy to stay here with Moshe Rabbeinu. So he's not going to be the first person to speak up. Now, if he saw how terrible the sin of the spies, you know, what it did to Am Yisrael, how a whole generation died out, was worse than Cheta Egel, don't you think it's a little silly on his part when they come into Eretz Yisrael to send out spies? I mean, did he not learn his lesson? It's not like he wasn't there. How did he send out spies after seeing the tragedy that the first incident caused? Any suggestions?
The war tactic.
Okay, so was the first one.
What are we getting ourselves into before we even think about war?
Okay, good. So here's the thing. You have to understand, most of you, when you read Chumash, you just read Rashi, there's lots of Mefarshim. The Ramban says there was no problem sending out the spies. It's a war tactic. Of course you have to gather as much intelligence about the enemy as you can before you go into battle. Otherwise, you'll have senseless loss of life on your side. Gather information. The sin of the spies was they decided to overstep their bounds. They were supposed to just gather information. They decided to give their editorial, what they think of it as well. Right? I'm first give an example of, let's say I say to Judah, here, go buy me this suit. And Judah says, I went, but it's overpriced. I didn't ask him for his opinion. I said, go buy me the suit. They came back with their opinion. Not just the facts, but their opinion. And this is where they messed up. Now, Yeshua rectifies the situation. How? First of all, instead of 12 well-known people, everyone knows they're being sent. How many people are sent?
12.
Two. Anyone know that they're being sent? Just Yeshua. Who do they report back to? Just Yeshua. Does anyone even know their names? No. They're anonymous people, right? Anonymous people, right? This is the cool thing, or the not so cool. This is the cool thing about being a spy, okay? I remember watching a movie, I think it was called The Farm, Al Pacino's in it, and like new recruits of CIA, and he says to them, you should realize the job is a difficult job, the pay stinks, you won't be able to tell any of your friends what you're doing, only your failures will be known, no one will know about your successes. You still in? All right, that's what it means to be a spy. These people, we don't know their names. Chazal give names, fine, but we don't know their names because what's important is the mission. Not the people. They go, they get the job done, they come back. Why is it important? Because once they bring back this great report, it psychs up in Israel, and they see how scared the enemy is. They see that this was going to be easy. Okay? And this is why he does it. Yeshua learns. He learns that it is important, but he learns how not to do it, what to do correctly. Now, it's interesting, both Yeshua and Kalev, the two good spies, they represent the tribes of Bnei Yosef and Bnei Yehuda. These are the two most important shvatim, and they come from our two imaot, the firstborn of Rachel, well, not the firstborn of Leah, but the two main tribes from Rachel and Leah. Okay, throughout Jewish history, the job of Rachel is to enable Leah to attain greatness. Rachel enables Leah to enter the family of Yaakov. Later on, Yeshua becomes the first king, okay, based on what I said before, from Bnei Rachel, paving the way. Shaul is from Bnei Rachel. He is the first person anointed to become king, paving the way for the kings from Yehuda. And Mashiach ben Yosef will pave the way for Mashiach ben David. This is the idea of spies. Third experience. Yeshua is a warrior. He is picked to lead the battle against Amalek. He paves the way and gives them the battle experience to then go and fight against the kings in Eretz Israel. He learns from Moshe on the mountain that the battle is fought on two planes, the physical and the spiritual. Moshe was up there davening. Yoshua understands both sides. Before the first battle, Yoshua is visited by an angel. And the angel tells Yoshua, take off one shoe. This is different than Moshe Rabbeinu at the snap. Moshe Rabbeinu is told, take off both shoes. Why? Take off your shoes? Because the ground that you're standing on is holy. Yoshua is told, take off one shoe. What's the idea? So I think it's, here's the message. On the one hand, understand that this ground is holy. There's a special relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu here. Take off a shoe. What's the keeping a shoe on? What is keeping a shoe on? What does it mean to keep your shoes on? What? So what's the shoe on representing then? Being ready for battle. What? Right, being ready. We were told to get ready on Leil HaSeder. Leil HaSeder, we are dressed with our shoes on, ready to go. Right, my oldest son was an officer in the army when they took his unit into Gaza in 2009, and he told me he didn't let his soldiers sleep without their boots on. You have to be ready at all times. A battle could break out in a second. No time to lacing up your boots. Right, you have to be ready. Have one shoe off, one shoe on. It's this connection between understanding that the ground we're fighting for, the land we're fighting for is holy, and being ready to do it. This is Yoshua as the warrior. And then we have Pnei Moshe kepnei Chama, Pnei Yoshua kepnei Levana. We have an idea in the Gemara that says, Moshe Rabbeinu is compared to the sun, Yoshua is compared to the moon. So I always thought that that meant he's a lesser form of Moshe. You know, the sun is extremely, you know, powerful, and he gets all of his greatness from him, but it's not as good. But I'm going to get to in a second a different idea. But first, Pnei Moshe kepnei Chama, Pnei Yoshua kepnei Levana, there's different people that are needed for different situations. We're now changing our way of life. We're no longer going to have this miraculous existence, mun being delivered to the doorstep. Now we have to work the ground. Now we have to be involved in agriculture. And now this time calls for new leaders. Yoshua is a homegrown talent. Moshe Rabbeinu, he's brought up in a palace. He only comes back at the age of 80. Yoshua, he was shoulder to shoulder with the people here. And he's more of, you know, roll the shirt sleeves up and get involved with everybody. And that's what they needed now, coming in. They needed this type of leader for the conquest of Eretz Israel. The Gemara Nedarim tells us that had we not sinned, there would have been no need for most of Tanakh. What would we have needed? Just the Chamish Shechum Shei Torah and Sefer Yoshua. The rest is Musar. But the Sefer Yoshua is viewed as the epilogue. The epilogue to the Torah. The goal, the purpose was, Moshe was told, take them out of Mitzrayim, bring them to Eretz Yisrael. Moshe, we spoke about last time, wasn't able to get that last job done. This is the epilogue. Yoshua is now bringing them in. There's the Arba Lashonot of Geula, but there's really the fifth. What's the fifth? Veveti. Veveti, bring them in. This is Yoshua's job. This is what they're doing. If Moshe was compared, we said last time we compared him a little bit to Herzl, Yoshua would be the Ben-Gurion. Right? The person now, all the problems of setting up a nation in its homeland. He had to deal with all of that. Very difficult task. The last day of Moshe's life, he tells Bnei Yisrael that he knows that after he dies, they're going to go off the Derech. But we see, all the life of Yeshua, they don't. To the point that the Gemara has to say, Rashi quotes, Mikan she'talmido shel adam chaviv alav kegufo. Kol zman she'Yeshua chai nireh le'Moshe ke'ilu hu chai. He was such an amazing Talmud that it was as if Moshe was still alive. Yeshua succeeded Moshe. It was as if Moshe was still here. They don't go off the Derech till after Yeshua's death. Now, I said before, Yeshua had the largest shoes in history to fill. And yet, with all the difficulties they had, 7 years of battles, 7 years of battles, they didn't conquer everything. Some Shvatim had majority of non-Jews living there. They have all these problems, and yet, no one complains to Yoshua. It's the weirdest thing. You would think, Bnei Yisrael, I'm Kshei Orif. We have no problem fighting with Moshe Rabbeinu. Time after time. And here it is, some guy's chosen, and they're not fighting with him. They're not complaining. How do you not complain with Yoshua every time something goes wrong? In Torah, they're at Moshe's throat, and over here, no one complains to Yoshua. What a remarkable thing. So I'll tell you this idea of Rav Yigal Ariel. It's my favorite idea on Yoshua. He says, what does it mean, Pnei Moshe, Kepnei Chamak, Pnei Yoshua, Kepnei Levana? Right now, are the stars out in the sky?
Yes.
Do we see them?
No.
Why not? The sun is so powerful. It said Moshe Rabbeinu's greatness was so amazing, it dwarfed everybody. When Yeshua was given the job to now lead the people, he basically said, all right, guys, huddle up. I can't do this by myself. I need your help. Shivim Zakenim, you guys got to be there more than ever. The Nesim of, you know, every show, you, we've got this Sari Meya, Elif, you know what? Everyone's got a job to do. And everyone now felt important. Yeah, there was the moon, but every single star felt important. Who are you going to rebel against? You? Everyone felt part of this enterprise. He was great at delegating responsibility and letting everyone feel that they were part of it. And that's, I think, a beautiful idea, that instead of saying, Kepnei Chama, Kepnei, you know, Moshe Kepnei Chama, Yeshua's Kepnei Levana, just a lesser form, it was maybe that this generation needed the Levana, and they needed to feel a part of it. And that's what Yeshua was able to accomplish, something that Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't able to accomplish because his greatness was just too much. He was in a different level altogether. Okay. Now, I just want to talk quickly about the Shoftim and Devorah in particular. The period of the Shoftim should have been the greatest period in Jewish history, right? But it didn't happen that way. What's the main difference between a Shofet and a king? What's the main difference?
Shofet isn't based on lineage.
Good. There's no heir to the throne. Now, with kings, that's good. There's no confusion. But, I mean, pardon any English here. I mean, the fact that you have blue blood doesn't really mean that you're really worthy of being a leader. So look at the royal family, right? So, great. You're the only son, so you're the crown prince, so you're now going to be the king. Who says you're any good? In the period of the Shoftim, we had leaders that were picked by Kadosh Baruch Hu. And right afterwards, people could have davened immediately after the death of a leader, said, God, we need a new leader. And another great leader who would have been handpicked by God. But it didn't happen that way, right? Instead, the people after the leader, they would go off the derech, and they would do Avodah Zarah, and only when they're after Avodah Zarah, and God wasn't protecting them, and they were being subservient, and they were dying, and they were getting, you know, conquered, and they called out, and so okay, it became the dark ages of Jewish history. It need not have been that way. What is a shofet? Okay, so it's a judge, but in the Sefer Shoftim, it was a leader. Okay, it was a leader. He was threefold responsibilities. He was a political leader, he was a military leader, and he was a religious leader. Okay, Hashiveinu Shalteinu Kol Shana, I think of leaders. I don't just think it's talking about judges. We're looking for leaders like we used to have. Real good leaders. That's what the Shoftim were. Of all the Shoftim, about a dozen, all right, Rashi has this idea, the Yubar Benel argues, but that was like one per Shofet. It doesn't say that. And the Yubar Benel, that's, I think, convincing arguments that some of the anonymous ones were certainly not from these tribes that weren't mentioned, but where they lived, it seems that they were from other areas. But at least a dozen Shoftim. Of all of them, the most unique was obviously Devorah. She was the only female Shofet. She's only one of seven female women that were prophets. And she was the only Shofet that was a Navi. All right, so she's obviously very special. The Rambam talks about how what kind of high level you have to be to attain Nevuah. So she was on this tremendously high level to become a Neviah. Some say that's why she became a Shofet after. She already reached this level. And if so, in this regard, she's like Shmuel, that was first a Navi before he became a leader. We find with all this that she, you know, as Rabino would say, she was normal. She was married. She's called Eshet Lapidot, right? Probably she had a family, and yet she's also involved with society. She's a Shofet, she's a Nevi'ah. It's not clear what Shevet she comes from. Could be Ephraim, that's where offices were. Chazal say she was married to Barak, and if so, then she would come from Naphtali. He was the general. Okay. Now, why did Chazal say married to Barak? I think because the way she bosses him around. right? You know, like, so a woman, she's like, yo, right over here now. Okay, you got to do this. You know, that's like, I once, when I was a little tipsy on Purim, I gave this vart on the Megillah. So it says in the Megillah that Esther and Mordechai married, right? So I said, what's the proof that Esther and Mordechai are married? She said, you can't wear that here. Take this. You have to change your clothes. You have to wear something else, right? It was in a sackcloth. Anyway, it doesn't matter. If you didn't get it, fine. Anyway, so, and if you're not married, you're not getting it so well. But Ralphie gets it. So you can't go out like that. So that's my verse. So here as well. She's walking around. It must be that she's married. Now, but we don't really know where her husband is. Why? Because, like, who's Mr. Golda Meir? No one knows, right? So she was that. She was super. She was doing all. It's Mr. Golda Meir. Anyway, now. She's often compared, sometimes you read in like not such religious literature, she was like the Jewish Joan of Arc. Now Joan of Arc, for those who don't know, she was this French peasant who had these visions, and she petitioned the king of France to let her lead the army against England. This was towards the tail end of the Hundred Year War in the 15th century. But Devorah never looked to lead the battle. She actually thought that Barak should have done it, and she thought he was like wussing out. But Barak felt that it was like a suicide mission. The people didn't really want to go. But if she would lead the battle, they would, you know, boost morale. It wasn't that she was squeamish. She just felt it wasn't her role. You see in her song that she's got a little bloodthirsty there. But she says, fine, you don't want to do it. I'll lead the battle. But just realize that you won't get any of the fame. Now, Pashup Shot is, people will say that I'm the one that led the battle. And the drush is that, you know, the battle will be won by Yael, which, you know, happens later on in the story. The truth is, her leading the battle might have led to Sisera's overconfidence. Sisera leads his troops, and they just surround Am Yisrael on a mountain. They're on Har Tavor. Har Tavor, when you're going down, you have a big advantage. But he said, to be led by a woman, you know, what kind of army could this be? So he said, we'll just, like, you know, make a siege around the bottom of the mountain, will starve them out. And then when they give them the message and they come and they fight going down, it's a lot easier. They don't have really much place to retreat because there's a nachal behind them. And then God helps out with the weather, making it so boiling that everyone hops out of their chariots because they're like frying in them and taking away the military advantage they had. And they're victorious in this battle. Now, after the war, we have this victory song of Devorah. Is that a good thing? So usually, look in Tanakh, these victory songs actually lead to bad things. Women started singing after Shaul and David fighting, and Shaul gets jealous because he understands that they're giving, at least in his eyes, more credit to David than to Shaul. Bat Yiftach comes running out to sing about the victory, and we know how that ends. Not so good for her. But the truth is, anytime women come out to sing after a battle, it's not a good thing because it leads to Gilui Arayos, right? The soldiers now just involved in Shvichas Damim, they go to Gilui Arayos. All the women running around, throwing themselves at the soldiers, but here it's different. Devorah's song is like Miriam's song. It wasn't to the soldiers. The song was to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Devorah recognized God's hand in everything they did. That's in between Perek Dalet and Perek Hey of Shoftim. Dalet tells us the facts. Hey, Devorah attributes all of this to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. She recognizes God's role. I mean, even in her song at the end, she has this stinging portrayal of Aim Sisera waiting for her son to come home. You know, where is he? You know, I made dinner. It's getting cold. Oh, well, you know, boys will be boys. He's just out pillaging and raping. He'll be home soon. Right, telling herself whatever she can to rationalize why he's not there until finally she realizes he's not coming back and she starts to cry. And the Gemara says the 100th Kiyot we have in Rosh Hashanah is because of the crying of Aim Sisera. What's the significance? Reality sets in. And that's what happens to us in Rosh Hashanah. What happens in Rosh Hashanah? We go through our lives saying, it's okay if I sin. God understands me. We're tight. You know? He gets it. I'm pretty good. So he overlooks the few things I don't do so well. Big deal. And all of a sudden, Yom HaDin comes and reality sets in. And that's the shofar. And that's the sister's crying. Aim sister's crying. This is the whole idea. Devorah recognizes everything. It's possible that she's like the last shofate that recognizes Klai Yisrael still together. Afterwards, they sort of separate into different municipalities. But she tries to gather a national army. She criticizes those who don't come. because this was a major highway that cut the country in half. This was important for Klal Yisrael. And she called herself Ein B'Yisrael, right? Because she's caring about not just her local area. She's caring about Klal Yisrael. But as I said, the most important part is the song that she recognizes Nes Nister is just that. It's a Nes. It's not coincidence. She said, oh, look how lucky we were. She recognizes God. And that's how we're supposed to live our life. We're supposed to live our life. I think Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said it. I heard it from one of our Rebbeim. I think in the name of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. But we're supposed to live our life as if God's not involved. That's how we should act. But we have to react afterwards and say, Baruch Hashem. I can't rely upon God. I have to do absolutely everything I can in my power. But afterwards, I have to say, oh, Baruch Hashem, that God was there helping me. This is the message I think we get from Devorah. Thank you very much. Baruch Hashem. Thank you.